طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The power of censorship. We continue to experience it as it is Israel's major weapon in trying to silence the worldwide growing criticism of its suffocation of the Palestinian people. This morning we will take a look at some of the vestiges of that censorship. We lead with a story that broke just a couple of days ago. It illustrates the kind of day-in, day-out assault on Palestinians who dare to tell their story or voice their narrative. We begin with a story from Mondo Weiss. The public theater in New York is slamming the door on Palestinian artists. The U.S. Friends of the Jenin Freedom Theater in Palestine made this statement. It is with deep regret that we announce that the public theater has decided not to proceed with the plans to showcase the Freedom Theater's The Siege in May of 2016. Regardless of the difficulties, we intend to present this play to the U.S. public. We are disappointed, but we are working to find another comparable venue for the fall of 2017. Signed, Friends of the Jenin Freedom Theater. The production had already been postponed 1 year at the request of the public theater, but with a promise to put it on this year. It was never on the official schedule, and the decision not to schedule it came down in recent days. Oscar Eustace, the trailblazing artistic director of the public theater, was behind the show all the way, but evidently intense pressure came to bear on the public theater board, a la the death of Klinghoffer pressures that came to bear on the Metropolitan Opera over that production, which went off in 2014, but with such opposition that the Metropolitan may well rue that decision. The public theater didn't want to take the chance, evidently. On a grander scale, Israel's public security minister has announced plans to censor worldwide social media platforms with the building of an international coalition to counter criticism of Israel. According to the Times of Israel, legislation is being planned in conjunction with European countries, most of which are very interested in the idea, to monitor and censor social media. Companies that do not comply will find themselves hauled into court facing financial penalties. As usual, this is being sold as a way to fight terrorism. Once again, Israel is conflating criticism with terrorism as a means to silencing its critics, this time across the internet. In the middle of last year, two reports came out which take a look at the efforts of the so-called Jewish lobby and several organizations that help constitute that lobby to silence pro-Palestinian activism on university campuses and beyond. The legal organization Palestine Legal, supported by the Center for Constitutional Rights and Jewish Voice for Peace, each issued reports documenting the assault on pro-Palestinian activism by the Jewish lobby and fellow organizations. One cannot help but be concerned about these efforts to silence speech within the heart of the very institutions which should be the most vigorous in protecting free speech and the principles of academic freedom. But censorship is alive and well on many U.S. campuses, and one does not realize the depth of it until one reads reports such as these, which document the sophisticated efforts. We know that literally millions of dollars are being spent by Jewish financial sources, organizations, and individuals to silence such undersourced groups as Students for a Just Peace in Palestine. For our feature presentation this morning, we have an interview conducted by The Real News Network out of Baltimore of Dimi Khalidi of Palestine Legal and representing Jewish Voice for Peace, Professor Judith Butler of the University of California, Berkeley. Here is that interview.
Welcome to The Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Pierce, coming to you from Baltimore. Over the last 10 years, there has been a growing resistance in the U.S. to Israel's violation of human rights, growing settlements and walls, and denial of land, livelihood, and economic development of Palestinians. Add to all of this the military operation launched by Israel between July 8th and August 26th of 2014. Palestinians now refer to this as 50 days of death and destruction by Israel. According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, at least 2,131 Palestinians were killed in Gaza as a result of Israel's Operation Protective Edge. At least 1,473 of the dead were civilians, including 501 children and 257 women. The resistance to all of this in the U.S. is a growing movement nationwide, particularly on college campuses, where many young Arab students are coming of age and acquiring consciousness about the politics of the region. This movement has taken on a life on college campuses, criticizing the Israeli government's continued assault on the people of Palestine, constituted by Arabs and a growing number of Jewish Americans. Campus groups have called on their universities to divest from companies that do business with Israeli corporations. The result, according to two reports released this week, is harassment, charges of anti-Semitism, intimidation, and even job loss and prevention of advancement for those who publicly speak out. One report titled "The Palestine Exception to Free Speech, a Movement Under Attack in the U.S. details 152 incidents of censorship, punishment, and sanctions in 2014 alone against pro-Palestine groups, and 150 incidents and 33 requests for assistance in anticipation of potential suspension. The second report released by the advocacy group Jewish Voices for Peace is titled "Stifling Dissent, How Israel's Defenders Use False Charges of Anti-Semitism to Limit Debate Over Israel on Campuses." To discuss all of this, I'm joined by two guests, Dimi Khalidi and Judith Butler. Joining us from Chicago is Dimi Khalidi. She is the founder and director of Palestine Solidarity Legal Support and cooperating counsel with the Center for Constitutional Rights. And joining us from Berkeley, California is Judith Butler. She is the Maxine Elliott Professor of Comparative Literature and Critical Theory at UC Berkeley and the author of several books on gender, sexuality, politics, and ethics. She is also on the advisory board for academic freedom with Jewish Voices for Peace. I thank you both for joining me today. So, Dima, let me begin with you. Was there any one incident that propelled you into doing this report? And if so, what was it?
Well, there have been many incidents, actually. Palestine Legal was founded in 2012 as a result of a number of high-profile incidents that we saw, including the prosecution and conviction of 10 students at the University of California, Irvine, for protesting a speech by the Israeli ambassador, a kind of unprecedented criminal prosecution for expressing views at a public lecture. So before the establishment of Palestine Legal, we were seeing a rise in these kinds of incidents of suppression of Palestine advocacy, especially on campuses. And since we were established, we have responded to nearly 300. This is just in the last 18 months, in fact, between January 2014 and June 2015. We responded to nearly 300 incidents of suppression on about 65 college campuses and, 24 different states. So it really is a widespread problem. It's not just a few isolated incidents we're seeing. I think several incidents in the last couple of years stand out, and they really illustrate the range of tactics that are being used against Palestine solidarity activists in order to silence them. And one that stands out, I think, is the case of Northeastern students who, were distributing flyers in the dorms. And as a result, they were visited by the campus police and called by the police and interrogated. Their group was suspended. Several students were disciplined. So we're seeing these kinds of disproportionate punishments of students and others and censorship of people who are expressing views on Palestine, because there's a lot of backlash from groups in this country that do not want that view to be aired. So they're engaging in a number of tactics to make sure that doesn't happen. And part of that is by pressuring universities and other institutions to cancel events or to punish student activities and to fire professors, as happened with Steven Salaita only last fall. His career has been ruined because of complaints about his tweets on the Israeli assaults on Gaza. So the effects are real for people here.
Judith, the Stifling Dissent, the report done by Jewish Voices for Peace, what are the types of incidences or suppression here that are categorically that led you to issue such a report?
Well, first, let me just say that I think Jewish Voice for Peace is enormously pleased to be publishing its report at the same time that Palestine Legal publishes its report. And I think these two reports should be read together, and they should be understood as an indication of a growing indignation on the part of many people concerned with campus politics and academic freedom with these tactics of intimidation. In my view, and the view of the report, really, there are kind of four general areas of concern. One is intimidation, the intimidation of students, undergraduates, graduates, intimidation of faculty, especially contingent faculty and non-tenured faculty, censorship, interventions into the curricula we teach, the books we teach, and sometimes also not allowing faculty or activists to speak on campus when their views don't coincide with mainstream Zionist understandings of the State of Israel and Palestine. I think there's also, in addition to intimidation and censorship, there's another way to limit debate, which is simply to say, as Hillel does, any speaker who doesn't actually defend the same view of Zionism that they hold to is not welcome at Hillel. So those students, mainly Jewish students who come to Hillel to understand their world and to understand Jewish values, are not allowed to actually hear a variety of viewpoints about Zionism at Hillel itself. Why wouldn't Hillel be a place that invites an open and robust debate? So what we've seen is the production of Open Hillel, a group of students who had to break off from Hillel because it limited debates so severely. And lastly, of course, we're also seeing forms of retaliation. Some of them are implicit. Young faculty members or graduate students who take certain kinds of critical positions on the State of Israel are being threatened with loss of job. We did see that in the Stephen Salaita case. They're being threatened with professional devastation and limitation, and also some state assemblies are now under pressure trying to pass laws that retaliate against individuals or institutions that have supported the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. All of these are issues of great concern.
And Judith, how broad is the fight against the Palestinian free speech? Because we now see that it's not just limited to campuses, it's also taken off a new life in terms of the divestment campaign in state governments.
I'm not sure how many people it represents, but I think that it's very forceful. The State of Israel has put a fair amount of money into its current campaign to fight what it calls the delegitimation of the State of Israel. It seems to me that open debate on Israeli policy or even open debate on Zionism is not the same as delegitimation. I mean, if the state understands itself as legitimate, it can enter that debate and say, we're legitimate. And certainly, legitimacy is not the only question that's being raised by many of the people who are targeted with censorship and intimidation. But there are groups like the Amcha Initiative. We don't know how large they are. They don't really publish their membership, if they have a membership. But their tactics are forceful, you know, blacklisting, making a list of students, faculty who have supported boycott, divestment, and sanctions or have refused to oppose it. What's the point of a blacklist? The point of a blacklist is to tell future employers that these people are a problem. Or a group like Stand With Us, which understands itself as doing advocacy work for the State of Israel. It takes an active stance against J Street, which is actually, for the most part, a Zionist organization, which has some criticisms of the State of Israel. It actually calls itself pro-Israel, a language I don't really understand. It sounds like football. But in any case, members of Stand With Us violently assaulted Jewish Voice for Peace members in Berkeley at a divestment hearing in 2010. And then there are other groups as well that that tend to characterize Muslim student associations as terrorists. So this kind of really appalling language and irresponsible speech and retaliatory methods and intimidation techniques are becoming quite common. I don't know, they're strong in the sense that they cause a scandal and they do frighten administrators, but I'm not sure how many people actually are behind these efforts. I think it's a good question.
Now, how much of this campaign against Palestinian free speech is rooted back to the State of Israel?
Well, we don't know exactly, but we, as you said, there have been reports that the government of Israel is putting money, resources towards this. The Prime Minister himself has said that they that the state will work to engage in lawfare against those who are advocating for Palestinian rights, especially through boycott, divestment, sanctions. And you know, we also know that there are connections between certain Israel advocacy groups that are engaging in these tactics and the state of Israel. So an organization like Shurat Hadin, the Israel Law Center, which is behind a lot of litigation and lawsuit threats here and around the world. We saw they have threatened the American Studies Association with a lawsuit, as well as others. We know that there are connections between them and the Israeli state as well, that they may even be taking direction from the state of Israel. So the connections are there. There's also evidence that Stand With Us has close connections with the state of Israel. So they're undeniable. The depth of them, I think, is not fully known.
I think we are moving into a kind of McCarthyism where we have already moved. It seems to me that many of the people who defended the firing of Stephen Salaita did so precisely on ideological grounds. They didn't like his point of view, and they also presumed they knew what his point of view was. And that was a non-hiring or a firing, really, that was based on a kind of panicked understanding of his views. But the truth is that people have been arguing about boycotts for a very long time. Divestment, sanctions, these are established methods, and they belong to a nonviolent movement that's seeking broad freedoms and justice for the people of Palestine. One can be for it, one can be against it, but it's properly part of debate in any democratic society, and to try to shut it down and to scare people into thinking that their lives will be ruined and their professional prospects ruined is really, I think, not only an abrogation of basic principles of freedom of expression and freedom of association, but it's an active practice of censorship that should be opposed on both legal and political grounds.
And Dima, of the 152 incidences of censorship, punishment, sanctions that you have documented, and this has been over the period of 2014 against pro-Palestinian groups, how many of them are as severe as Salaita's case?
Salaita's case is one of the more severe that we've seen in terms of repercussions for faculty, certainly. But we see on a daily basis the same kind of effect that the case Salaita's case has had, where faculty are intimidated or you know, silenced because of their views. We have seen a couple of other cases of faculty being terminated, certainly being attacked for their courses or programs that they put on. The Middle East Studies Association, the Middle East Studies programs have been attacked. There's been an attack on the funding, federal funding for Middle East Studies programs, claiming that they are not balanced and that they violate certain laws, which is not the case, certainly. So we're seeing a broad-based attacks. The kinds of cases we deal with are also, it's a progressive situation. So we see a lot of pressure being put on universities after a student group does an action, for example. We see a complaint. We saw several complaints to the Department of Education about Palestine activism on campuses. And while these complaints were dismissed ultimately, there were investigations that were open for years, and it resulted in another tactic that we're seeing, which are a number of bureaucratic barriers being placed to prevent students from organizing, security fees being imposed on them before they have an event, being called into the administration to discuss what they are going to say, to give lists of their membership, to give them scripts of their mock checkpoints on campuses. So the effects are more than just people losing their jobs. It's a matter of student activists and others who are made to feel like what they're doing is wrong, criminal somehow, and then we see a lot of law enforcement scrutiny as well being put on them. So these accusations of anti-Semitism, of terrorism, are really troubling. There's really a range of tactics that are being used here, and their effects also range. But there's it's really disturbing how much of this we're seeing, and even if it's not a firing, it has a real effect on people.
Judith, how does Jewish Voices for Peace actually advise people how to deal with this false accusation of anti-Semitism?
Well, I think that the main point that Jewish Voice for Peace has communicated on this issue is that to criticize the state of Israel for its policy on Palestine, which would include its occupation, which would include the siege of Gaza, which would include the dispossession of Palestinians in 48, and then again in the last many decades, every time new borders were drawn, to offer those kinds of criticisms is certainly not anti-Semitic. One is not attacking the Jewish people. One's not making any claims about who the Jewish people are. One is criticizing a state for unjust policies, and one is criticizing a state for an ongoing subjugation of a minority population that is and is not within its national boundaries. So I think we need to disarticulate those two. I think there's a great fear of being accused of anti-Semitism. Many Jewish people also mute their own criticisms of Israel because they're afraid of being accused of self-hatred, or they're being accused of collaboration with anti-Semitism. But many Jews are not in agreement with the state of Israel. The Pew Center published a very interesting poll that suggested that the majority of Jews in the United States don't have strong feelings about Israel. So, and then the rest of us are obviously arguing with one another. I don't know any Jewish dinner table where that argument isn't happening. We're a diverse and complex people with many political points of view. I don't think you can say that the state of Israel adequately or fully represents the views of the Jewish people. It's simply not true.
And Dima, the last word to you. One of the things cited in the report is the ways in which legislation is being used in order to stifle free speech. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, we've seen certainly since the American Studies Association passed a resolution to endorse the academic boycott of Israeli academic institutions in December 2013, we saw a wave of legislation that directly attacked BDS and the academic boycott in particular. So in 2014, we saw about 11 such pieces of legislation being introduced. With a lot of opposition to this legislation, the bills that were introduced did not pass. And a lot of these bills actually try to defund universities that subsidize associations like the ASA that endorse the boycott. So, such a clearly unconstitutional bill did not pass muster in several states where it was introduced. We've also seen a number of non-binding resolutions that have been introduced that condemn the academic boycott, that say it's anti-Semitic, that profess their undying loyalty to the state of Israel. And so many of those have passed, often unanimously in state legislatures. And we've seen more of that this year. And there is a promise of more to come. In Illinois, a bill passed that actually forces the state pension system to divest from companies that boycott Israel. So we're expecting more legislation like this that basically imposes the state's view of this issue on people. And it's troubling. It has a serious chilling effect. And it raises serious constitutional questions as well. So there's a bill pending in Pennsylvania as well that tries to defund universities. So this is a broad-based attack. We saw Sheldon Adelson himself pledge millions of dollars to combat BDS and Palestine activism in general, he has said that much of that will go towards lawfare, towards lawsuits, legislation directly attacking the BDS movement. So we're expecting more of this, and it's a really troubling trend. But we do know that in this country, the right to boycott is protected by the First Amendment. It's very clear, given the history of social justice boycotts in this country, from the civil rights era, this is a constitutionally protected speech activity and associational activity. So there's only so much impact that this legislation can have without violating First Amendment rights, and so it's very clear that people should not should understand that this doesn't affect their right to advocate for BDS, and the impact is really more of the chilling effect that these things have, and the pronouncements of state policy here.
Dima Khalidi and Judith Butler, I thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
That was an interview with Dima Khalidi of Palestine Legal and Professor Judith Butler of the University of California, Berkeley, representing Jewish Voice for Peace. For those interested in reading the Palestine Legal Report, the name of it is The Palestine Exception to Free Speech, A Movement Under Attack in the United States. To view the full report, visit palestinelegal.org, all one word, palestinelegal.org. In the interview just concluded, Dima Khalidi referenced the attempts of pro-Israel groups to pass legislation here in the United States at the state level to prohibit boycotting Israeli goods, a direct attempt to challenge the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Campaign, BDS. On the one hand, Israel tries to make light of the BDS movement, but on the other hand, it is going all out to oppose it. We have been covering these efforts on This Week in Palestine, and here is an update written by Alex Kane in Mondo Weiss. Advocates of boycotting Israel are under attack in a number of states across the country. State legislatures in California, New York, Indiana, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Florida are debating anti-boycott measures. Most of them would penalize people or businesses that support the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions BDS movement, targeting Israel over human rights violations. Some of the bills would also hit those who only advocate for boycotting products made in Israel settlements. Supporters of the BDS movement are now mobilizing to try to defeat the bills, and in Maryland, Activists say an anti-boycott bill a local Jewish group wanted to push for was defeated after the Freedom to Boycott Coalition protested and lobbied against the measure. Some of the measures in other states have passed in the Assembly or Senate in a state, but they have not yet been signed by the governors of that state. The wave of anti-boycott bills is backed in some states by pro-Israel organizations. The measures are the latest line in the series of attacks the BDS movement has faced in state legislatures around the U.S. since 2014, when the American Studies Association passed a resolution in favor of boycotting Israel. Last year, 22 anti-BDS bills were introduced in the U.S. legislatures. Lawyers warn that the measures may be unconstitutional and could chill speech that is critical of the state of Israel. BDS is gaining momentum, and that's scaring a lot of people. That's scaring a lot of Israel advocates, said Rahul Saxena, an attorney at Palestine Legal, a group that fights back against attempts to curb speech in favor of Palestinian rights. Saxena said that instead of debating the movement, pro-Israel groups are trying to shut the movement down. One of the most alarming bills is being debated in New York, which became the first state to consider anti-BDS bills in 2014, but not the first state to pass a measure. In May 2015, South Carolina's government became the first to pass legislation penalizing businesses that boycott countries South Carolina trades with. Boycotts of Israel were the clear target. The New York bills, there are two similar versions, would not only require the state to divest from companies that boycott Israel or products made in the occupied West Bank, it would also create a list of individual people and entities that boycott Israel and post that list on the New York State website for the Office of General Services. It is the most unconstitutional bill considered, said Saxena. Though the others also raise constitutional issues. Advocating for boycotts is protected speech under the U.S. Constitution. One of the New York bills passed the state Senate in January by a 55-6 vote and is now being debated in the Assembly. While that version applies to any of the boycotts of allied nations, the sponsor of the Assembly version of the bill only talked about the BDS movement when introducing it. The other version of the bill, which only mentions Israel, is being discussed in committee in the Assembly and in the Senate. Palestinian rights activists say the New York bill would create a blacklist reminiscent of the McCarthy era, when Hollywood shunned any writer, producer, or actor alleged associated with communism. And Josh Rubner, policy director of the U.S. campaign to end the occupation, told the Electronic Intifada he is worried that the pro-boycott church groups who receive money from New York would see their funding slashed because of the bill. Palestine Legal's Saskana said that Florida's bill may also punish churches that have taken pro-Palestinian stands. New York passed a resolution condemning BDS last year, but it had no teeth. The Jewish Community Relations Council advocated for the resolution, according to reporter Jacob Kornbluh, who writes on the Jewish community. The other states, California, Indiana, and Florida, are considering bills that have similar language. They would prohibit their states from contracting with companies that boycott Israel. The Florida Senate and Indiana House have passed their measures, though they have to pass both the Senate and the House in these states to reach the governor. California is still debating the measure. The Virginia House passed a resolution condemning BDS for being one of the main vehicles advocating for policies leading to the dissolution of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. Another Virginia bill directs the Virginia-Israel Advisory Board to examine how the BDS movement might impact businesses in the state and its ability to attract investment. Last year, a legislature in Pennsylvania introduced a bill to cut off funding to universities that boycott Israel, similar to a New York bill that was defeated in 2014. But activists have successfully defeated anti-boycott bills in the past. Earlier this year, the Baltimore Jewish Council said they would push for a bill to prevent companies boycotting Israel from doing business with the Maryland state government. Now, activists in that state say they have quashed the prospect of that bill being introduced in the legislature. The Freedom to Boycott Coalition has clearly had a huge impact in derailing the Baltimore Jewish Council, BJC, plan to push an anti-BDS bill in Maryland. While the BJC announced that it will not pursue a bill, it has continued to lobby representatives and monitor the legislature for any last-minute attempts to sneak a bill through as an amendment, which has been done before. Allison Glick, a member of the Freedom to Boycott Coalition and Jewish Voice for Peace, said in an email, "We will use our momentum to continue educating our legislatures about what BDS really is and why it is important for achieving justice in Israel-Palestine." That was an update of state legislature activity to counter the BDS movement, written by Alex Kane, a freelance journalist. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org or check our archive of past broadcasts online at truthandjusticeradio.org. All one word, truthandjusticeradio.org. Click on This Week in Palestine Archives, and you have the entire archive. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will feature a presentation by the late Palestinian intellectual, Columbia professor Edward Said. We constantly hear that at the base of the conflict in the Middle East is a clash of civilizations. This theory, espoused by Harvard professors Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington in essays and books, claims that at the heart of the conflict is the fundamental difference between Eastern and Western cultures and values, and of course argues for Western dominance. In a speech titled "The Myth of the Clash of Civilizations," Professor Said profoundly challenges that theory. We feature this presentation on This Week in Palestine because at the base of the Islamophobia and anti-Arab speech in the media, and at the center of so much of our political discourse these days, is the emphasis of our differences. It is the clash of civilizations mantra, and it has taken over our discourse. Edward Said's voice offers a special relevance. It challenges the mantra and provides a more hopeful and optimistic way forward, even though this speech was given in the late 1990s. Edward Said died in 2003, but we need his voice today more than ever, and you shall have it next week on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC, 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.